Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, my guest is the man who literally wrote the book, or at least co-wrote the book, on perfect solar eclipses as evidence for intelligent design. Which is rather timely, because for the first time in many years, the United States is about to be treated to a perfect solar eclipse on August 21st. And not just a perfect solar eclipse, but if you're in the right spot, a fairly long one, more than 3 minutes in some spots. What does any of this have to do with intelligent design? Well, have you ever stopped to marvel at the odd fact that the moon just happens to be almost exactly the same apparent size in the sky as the sun? Maybe not, but if you've ever had the privilege of witnessing a perfect solar eclipse, the curious coincidence sort of slams you in the face. The moon fits just perfectly over the sun, covering the sun but only just barely. And it was a perfect solar eclipse that provided the first clue, the Eureka moment, that led to the extraordinary book, The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. The first chapter is all about how perfect solar eclipses are maybe the most obvious illustration of an intriguing pattern in the cosmos. And as I noted, we have on the show today one of the book's authors, Jay Richards, a senior fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He's also the executive editor of The Stream, and an assistant research professor at the Tim and Steph Bush School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Great to be with you, Andrew.
So in The Privileged Planet, you argue that perfect eclipses don't just seem designed because of the eerie fit of moon on sun. Mm-hmm. You argue that the evidence for design here runs much deeper. But before we unpack that, I want to know, are you going to see the perfect eclipse?
I am going to see the eclipse. In fact, ever since my older daughter, Jillian, was born in 1999, we have been planning to find our way to the path of totality. And so I live here in the Washington, D.C. area. We're driving down to Columbia, South Carolina, which is about the closest place that also has a long totality. So as you mentioned, there's a few places that get almost up to 3 minutes. But in a lot of places, it'll be about 2.5 minutes. In other words, the sun will be entirely eclipsed by the moon for about 2.5 minutes. That's called totality. People might, if they're not considering doing this, I would just encourage listeners, find your way to the path if you can at all. It's only about 70 miles wide. Starts, it's going to make landfall about 9 a.m. that morning in Oregon, and then it will end and go off the coast in South Carolina about 2:30 or 3 p.m. South Carolina time. So that means it's going to cross the entire continental United States, and that's the first time in 100 years that this has happened. The last time we had a total eclipse anywhere in the United States is actually in 1979. So this really is a kind of a once-in-a-century opportunity. And for the first time, almost all Americans are within 1 day's drive of the path of totality. So unless you're trapped in a dungeon or sick or just can't get a day off work, I strongly encourage listeners, try to find a place where you can see not just the partial eclipse, which is visible pretty much everywhere in the U.S., but the total eclipse.
So a fairly special cosmic event. And as you point out, a narrow path, but within reach of many Americans. So The Privileged Planet actually points out that we're actually lucky to have perfect eclipses at all.
Yeah, we are. In fact, my co-author actually did a study of this in the late 1990s because he was thinking, well, gosh, this is an amazing coincidence that the moon and the sun, which are totally different kinds of objects, they're both spheres, but totally different sizes. One's a ball of hot gas and plasma, the other's a big round rock. And yet they basically match in our sky. That is, the moon is about 400 times smaller than the sun, but it's also about 400 times closer. So you get this eerie match between the apparent size of the sun and the moon in the sky. That by itself is neat. And he did a research project and discovered that essentially the only place you could view perfect solar eclipses where you get this neat match is just where there are observers to appreciate them. So in other words, the one place where there are beings that can view solar eclipses in our whole solar system is the Earth and nowhere else. So we get better eclipses than any of the other planets with their 65 or more major moons. So that itself is interesting, but it really just kind of pointed to part of the argument that we actually develop in the book. By itself, most astronomers say, well, this is just one of these weird coincidences. And they're certainly right that the laws of physics don't require this, obviously. There's lots of different various relevant sizes or relative sizes that a moon or a star could appear from the position of a planet. What's eerie about this, though, is that in the case of solar eclipses, the two main ingredients, the size of the sun in our sky and the size of the moon in our sky, are actually fixed by requirements for the habitability of Earth. In other words, you need to get certain things right in order for a planet to even be able to possibly host life, especially you need a surface with liquid water on it for long periods of time. And so that means that your planet, if you want it to be in a habitable spot, it needs to be in the so-called circumstellar habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone around a star. It's basically not too hot, not too cold. So it's just right for life. So when you get a planet in that zone, that's going to set up how big your star is in your sky, in our case, the sun. That's one factor needed for habitability of a planet. Another factor is a large, well-placed moon. If our moon suddenly disappeared, the Earth would start wobbling erratically on its axis and make it very hostile over the long term for life. So in other words, two of the ingredients you need to make a planet habitable have to do with the size of the planet, the sun in your sky, and the size and location of your moon in your sky. And when you get those things set up, those two independent things set up, it just happens to produce perfect solar eclipses. That's the initial kind of eerie thing, honestly, that led us to think maybe there's more to this.
Yeah. So it's not just that it happens, it's that we can see it happen and observe it and do science based on it and study it.
That's right. That's the key. So just by itself, the fact that we see perfect eclipses, that's neat. And in fact, I had an atheist on the radio one time admit to me that that by itself was kind of eerie. But that doesn't really make for a design argument by itself. It's just, oh, wow, it's a cool coincidence. It's when you connect it to the conditions for doing science that it becomes intriguing. So as I've already described, when you get these two arrangements, this arrangement of a planet, its location with its moon and its sun, you can see perfect solar eclipses from your observer platform. That's needed for life. It also means that when you get perfect solar eclipses, though, as it happens, you get a sort of natural experiment in which things are set up to allow Earth-bound scientists to make scientific discoveries that they would have had a very hard, if not impossible, time making otherwise. So in other words, perfect solar eclipses are like an experimental setup, set up by someone else to allow Earth-bound astronomers to actually discover things they wouldn't know otherwise.
Yeah. Well, and then we have the choice, right? Take it for granted, call it coincidence, or ponder it. Think about it. What does it mean? I love how you start The Privileged Planet. It's actually a quote. Discovery is seeing what everyone else saw and thinking what no one thought.
That's exactly right. This by itself, again, might just be intriguing, but what my co-author and I thought is, I wonder if this is a pervasive pattern. In other words, we wonder, are the conditions needed in a planetary environment for life, do they also correspond to the conditions you needed in a planetary environment for scientific discovery? That would be an intriguing thing. So you could spend your whole life, let's say you're an astronomer and you do astrobiology, and so you do nothing but study what it takes in a planetary environment in order for life to exist. So you need a certain size of a planet, you need it to have the right kind of atmosphere, you need it to have the right kind of geology to produce a magnetic field to protect the surface, you need the right kind of star, the right distance from the star, and on and on and on. And you come up with this list of things you need for habitability. There's another scientist somewhere else on the other side of the world, and he studies, okay, what would you need in a planetary environment in order to do certain kinds of science? So be able to learn about the recent past, to be able to learn about the composition and makeup of stars, both nearby and in the distance. So you can see stars both nearby and in the distance. So you can figure out the structure of our galaxy. So you can see distant galaxies and even detect the cosmic background radiation. What kind of a situation, what kind of ingredients would you need to have a really good science observing platform? Well, our argument is that you could take the results of those two scientific studies and put them together, and what you discover is that it's the same places. The places where you can see perfect solar eclipses are going to be the places where there are beings that can see them. The places where you can see the distant galaxies is going to be the right location in a galaxy to host life, and on it goes. So that it's not just that you need a lot of stuff to go right to get a life-bearing planet someplace in the universe, but that there seems to be this pervasive pattern so that the needs for life and the needs for scientific discovery, they end up being the same places. So observers will find themselves in the best places for observing. Scientists will find themselves in the rare best places overall for doing science. That, we think, is very suggestive.
Yeah. We have gazed up at the moon for centuries, and at least in the 20th century, we're able to get there and take a closer look at it. Well, how does the moon connect to our habitability? What exactly does it do to help us?
It does several things. It plays a role in the tides, and the ocean tides are very important for mixing over long terms the nutrients that life needs. Without a kind of the right mix of land and water and tides, the nutrients that life needs would tend to get settled down deep in the crust, and they wouldn't be available up near the surface where life needs it. That's one thing. The other really dramatic role the moon plays is that it stabilizes the Earth's tilt. Anyone that's looked at a globe notices globes don't stand upright. They are tilted about 23.5 degrees from sort of parallel to the ground. What that represents is the tilt of the Earth's axis on the plane that it has when it goes around the sun. And that's actually really good for giving us seasons, but also for making much of the surface of the Earth habitable to complex life. If we didn't have the moon, if you just knocked it out, the Earth would be like Mars. It would wobble on its axis dramatically over hundreds and thousands of years and make the climate really, really hostile to life. This is how it is in Mars. Mars is in many ways like the Earth. It just has two little tiny kind of potato-shaped moons. They're really captured asteroids. And they're so small, they don't do this. And so as a result, Mars, unlike the Earth, wobbles on its axis from zero to about 65 degrees. And it just makes essentially weather really, really hostile to life. And so we've often looked up at the moon and been glad that it was there. It's been interesting to us. But its presence actually makes the Earth more hospitable to life than it would be otherwise.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of evidence showing the importance of this, but it takes a while for people to let it sink in. So if solar eclipses were the beginning and end of it, you wouldn't really have had a book, would you? You found this happening in other areas of the universe and in other ways. Is that right?
That's right. And so initially we both talked about this. This was way back in 1999 or 2000. Thought, well, now that's interesting, but you know, we'd need to see if this proved true. That is, this pattern between habitability and measurability, as we call it in the book. Does this pattern prove true for these other things life needs? And so we really worked our way through all the other examples. So the type of atmosphere we have a nitrogen and oxygen rich atmosphere, which makes it mostly transparent to visible light. As it happens, visible light is really the most information rich part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It comes right through our atmosphere. It's also the thing that life needs. So our atmosphere protects us from much of the kind of deadly radiation, but lets the type of energy from the sun that life needs through. It turns out it's that same narrow part of the electromagnetic spectrum. I mean, this is a tiny slice. If you think about radio waves on the long end to X-ray and gamma rays on the short end, the visible light spectrum that we think of as the rainbow is a tiny little sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. As it happens, that's what life needs, and it's also what's most useful for doing science. So in other words, less life-hospitable atmospheres, like Titan's atmosphere, a moon of Saturn, it not only prevents you from seeing the stars and the planets around you, it also prevents the type of energy from the sun that you need on its surface. So just example after example after example, the location you need to be in your galaxy in order to have a habitable system. It's also the best place in the galaxy for being able to, one, figure out the structure of the galaxy and also see to distant galaxies outside our own. So that was sort of kind of a remarkable discovery because it's really kind of a cumulative case argument. If you just had one example in which you said, okay, it turns out the things you need for a habitable planet also allow you to see perfect solar eclipses, which allow you to make scientific discoveries, that would be neat. But at some point, when you get a preponderance of examples of this pattern over and over and over again, then we argue that you really have a cumulative case argument that weighs in favor of design versus chance. Or really, here's the way I would put it. This is the simplest way to put it. Imagine you have two hypotheses. One hypothesis is that the universe is not only fine-tuned for life, but for scientific discovery. The other hypothesis is just the chance hypothesis, that whatever's happened is the result of blind processes, maybe deterministic laws of physics and random events. So those are your two hypotheses. The discovery that the conditions for life and the conditions for scientific discovery correlate in very rare places is much easier to explain. In fact, it makes sense if the universe is designed for discovery. It makes no sense on the chance hypothesis. So essentially, the design hypothesis gets confirmed on that way of framing it. We don't claim this is a mathematically deductive proof for the existence of God or even for design, but we do think that it's a strong argument in favor of design, and that the whole thing makes a heck of a lot more sense if you think the universe is designed for discovery than if you don't.
It sure does. And your book, The Privileged Planet, succeeds because it's a cumulative case. You start with solar eclipses, which are awesome, and then you just go through all these examples. And by the end of the book, you realize there's something to this. And I do have to mention the documentary of the same name at this point. I used to be a teacher before I worked with Discovery Institute, and I showed this to my kids, and they were amazed. They just ate it up. The video does a great job of illustrating some of these examples from the book, and together they're just great resources. So this started with solar eclipses. Obviously, there's many more examples. If we had time, you could go into others. I appreciate the ones you've mentioned. Tell us what listeners can do to learn more about these topics.
I mean, honestly, just check out Evolution News and Views. Check out the resources at Discovery Institute. And also check out the articles that I've been writing at The Stream at stream.org, in which I first just describe what you need to do in order to see the eclipse here this month, but also just connect the dots a little bit more into these issues having to do with intelligent design and purpose. It's an exciting and mysterious and slightly eerie idea, but we're glad to finally be able to have a total solar eclipse in our country. This is actually the first one to happen since The Privileged Planet came out. So we're really excited. And I'm just hoping for a cloud-free day to be able to see it.
Sure. Well, thanks for getting us hyped up about it, Jay.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Andrew.
Yeah, great to talk with you. Well, again, you can learn more about The Privileged Planet book and documentary at the website privilegedplanet.com. If nothing else, check out the site's list of endorsements. Some really heavy hitters from the world of science endorse the book. That's privilegedplanet.com. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.